We have Richard Rose's Jacob's Ladder by Paul Constan, who couldn't come. So Phil is filling in. And Phil, since he was a child, has been curious about spirituality. As a teen, he began reading books by Krishnamurti, Gurdjieff, and Ostensky. His real seeking began when he turned the first page of Richard Rose's book, The Albigen Papers, at the age of 22. He met Rose a short time later, and for the next 10 years, he drastically changed his life. Phil is forever indebted to Mr. Rose. In 2007, Phil had a realization of, as he calls it, one awareness, which solved a massive awareness identity problem. On one level, it ended many questions, but on another, it was the start of so much more. Phil lives his life in accordance with the principle, no religion is greater than friendship. His life is filled with gratitude for friends and loved ones who share in something eternal and much deeper than life itself. In 1985, Rose opened the door of rapport to Phil, and ever since, he has been captivated by the idea of sitting in silence with spiritual friends. His love of silence grows deeper daily. Phil currently lives with his wife and love of his life, Cindy, near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and is employed in a place he unaffectionately refers to as Gilbert Land.
She asked me if I wanted to say something about employment, and that's about the best I could say. So I hope this weekend really brought what I felt in the introduction that TAT offers, and I find it very unique. I don't see or hear, and I'm not widely interspersed with a spiritual community, but I do feel in hearing other people that are, TAT's uniqueness, which is Richard Rose's legacy, is the friendship. And it's been expressed in many different ways this weekend. The conversations you have at lunch or over meals, the rapport is very unique. And the speakers we've had, it just, for me, creates a feeling, a very deep feeling that I'm just very indebted to TAT and what Rose started many years ago and just continues, and I think he would be really happy with what he would see today. So, and I hope I can read this I hope I can keep my composure, because this is the one poem that is very expressive of that. So this is Friendship by Richard Rose. I passed through a deep crevice at twilight, and I saw a narrow vista of trees, magical in the mist, vocal to the hush of meaning, whispering to the wisdom of shades of degrees. And before the backdrop of eternity, and I had a friend whose dust with mine was not the bond, whose love with mine was not the bond, whose teaching with me was not the bond. Both of us have been to this same place, to the twilight in the narrow crevice, and because of this place, we are eternal. So Rose, again, as I said, left TAT as a legacy. And for me, this weekend's about stories of discovery. And one of the things that Rose, the core of his teaching, I feel, is Jacob's Ladder. And my story of discovery is expressed through this ladder, because at some point after my realization, it dawned on me, I was just sitting on my porch, that I followed this for 20 years. And it wasn't until that culmination occurred when I looked back and I saw, my God, this is the path that I actually followed. So Rose, I think probably most people here have read his books, some of his books, his reading I get from other people. I never thought this, but people say it's difficult reading. Jacob's Ladder, part of the Psychology of the Observer, which is about halfway through the book. So I have a flag there about halfway through. The first part I feel sort of is tangential, but then he gets into the core in this. So to me, it is a little bit difficult, and it's somebody else's teachings. So I had to like extract his teachings from the book and sort of put it into my own words. So the first part of this, I'm going to go back and read some of this, so it might be a little bit dry. But as Francis said yesterday, if you get the intellectual side of this, and I hope you do pick up the feeling between the words, this stuff starts to sink in, and it becomes much more than words. It'll become an experience. So one of the things about me that people know about me is that I'm very determined. I can be very tenacious, and that's just a personality trait that Rose strongly encouraged. So for him and any teacher that I've really gravitated to, determination, persistence, that was something that really captivates me, and it's just something that's really instilled in me as well. And I feel like to take this Jacob's Ladder to its maximum does require a lot of intense application, a lot of determination. So depending on how long you've been a seeker, you might be asking yourself questions about the spiritual path. What do I really want out of life? What drives me to find answers, including the ultimate answer? What am I truly? A thinker in a body or mind? A watcher of thoughts? Or just awareness? Will anything of me survive death? So Rose assembled this diagram, and of course these diagrams don't encompass the whole teachings, but again it's just a nice representation of what he has to offer. And probably what I could do today, if anything, is what I would call put a pebble in your shoe by going through this. In a way, that pebble will sort of irritate you, hopefully. And after you leave here, something in you will stew over this. And I really feel like that intellectual side, even though it is sort of a thorn in your side or a pebble in your shoe, what really starts to open up is if you feel something more after you leave here. And so to me, the intellectual stuff sort of plants a seed that will later on open up a feeling. So Rose used what I can gather, the Jacob's Ladder, and I feel that he probably saw in the Old Testament where Jacob dreamt of a ladder set upon the earth and the top of it reached into heaven. And that might be where he got the parallel here. So you'll notice it consists, and you have a handout here with more details, but there's three main parts. So his body, mind, and essence. So let's look at the bottom triangle, and I'll try to keep this as straightforward as possible. I feel that probably nobody in this room is stuck down here on the bottom, so that's the good news. I feel like anybody who's done any kind of introspection or made the effort to come here is not trapped in this line AB. And basically, that's just the play of life that most people play out. So it's fears and desires, never seeing the relativity of good and evil, considering it very black and white, and never considering the shades in between. And Rose says, we can wallow here for a lifetime, endlessly choosing the positives and the negatives, accepting concepts of good and evil, struggling with desires and fears. So unless we do some introspection, we may never conceive of opportunities to rise above the relative nature of positive and negative. So as soon as you start to become more aware of your thoughts and feelings, you'll see this daily drama play out. And really it's expressed, the body has a lot of appetites and a lot of fears. So it's just expressed day to day as you're going through your day. And some of these can get into obsessions if you really let things get too carried away. So what this line AB is, just to give you some examples, you have desires. Will those desires physically harm me? So that's the fear side. Or will they get in the way of other desires? Our struggle for acquiescing to desires might be checked by fears. For instance, a voice might tell you to drink alcohol because it feels good. But then you know if you drink too much, you feel bad, you put on weight. There's all these repercussions to those basic appetites that are being expressed through your body. So our daily lives involve a profound pull outward. The body has this attention to pleasure and comfort, procreation, nerve titillation, through entertainment, food, sex, alcohol, drugs, power and acquisition, fear, pride, and many others. So that's the line that's being played out there with line AB. And we think that everything that happens to us is within our control or of our own doing. So we want to add qualities to ourselves to build ourselves up. And that's the ego feeding itself. Or the other interaction that you see every day is people tearing somebody else down. And I feel that's a form of bringing the ego up by taking other people and trying to tear them down in a way. So when you start to watch this mental drama through introspection, you'll reach a vantage point called somatic awareness, or the umpire in Rose's terms. So that's point C. And he used that word somatic. And somatic, if you go to the dictionary, means relating to or affecting the body, especially as distinguished from the mind or the environment. So that's somatic. So basically, somatic awareness is awareness of the body. So if you are able to leap up to this umpire, you have an advantage and you see all these things sort of playing out in your life below you. You kind of get detached a bit from that line AB. Now, Rose goes into a lot of details in this book about the value of the umpire, which is essentially, it's a programming, and it's meant to take care of things day to day. So I'm not saying it's always a bad thing. The good thing to say about that is you can take your umpire and sort of reprogram it. So in my experience, I thought at some point, if I get into the spiritual stuff, some part of me will survive. So it was a survival urge. There will be something that would be eternally living beyond the body. So that's sort of what dragged me into the whole spiritual search to begin with. It was a very selfish gravitation. But the umpire has it makes so many mistakes, and the big thing you can see day to day or as time goes on, I can sum it up in one word, and that's regrets. You've made mistakes. So the umpire makes a lot of mistakes. So it's not without problems. And Rose cites the book often, Hubert Benoit's Supreme Doctrine. And Benoit talks about this conciliatory principle that you must rise above to see the full spectrum, in this case, all the positives and negatives below. So Rose had his teaching had a system of tension built into it. And he often said the traumas in life would push you up above and see a clearer picture. And a trauma could be as a result of severe tension. So this rising to point to the point C will sort of get you out of the fear. I'm not saying immune to it, but it'll allow you to step back from the fear, desire, play in your life. And again, these are often sudden leaps that will take you up as a result of tension or trauma. Now, this isn't what I would say spiritual per se. I'm just saying this is just an advantage to step up above this, to get to the next, to that rung on the ladder. In Rose, one of the core parts of his teachings was that you don't strive for something that you don't know you want. So in this case, you're retreating from the error. And he used that term a lot. So you see the error of line AB and you retreat into the next step of the ladder. So it's a retreat from error. And he used the term even retreat from untruth. So you never define what the truth is. You're backing into it. You're retreating from untruth. And so this umpire thing no longer becomes a concept because it's an experience. It just becomes an experience that you back into. Now this, the umpire is more of a logical mechanism, so it feels that there's a step by step by step. So if you do something, it'll have a predictable reaction. And that's the logic side of the equation here. But we all know, if you've done some introspection, that there's a lot more than just a step-by-step cause and effect. And so there's this other side of the spectrum, which is intuition. And Rose was extremely intuitive, and he was it wasn't a result of his enlightenment. He was psychic even as a child, and he was very sensitive. And one of the things that's sort of funny in retrospect, a lot of people were on pins and needles around him because often enough he was picking up on your thoughts. So if you let your thoughts get too morbid around him, you would pick up on it. So you had to be on your toes a bit. So it made you watch yourself all the time. It was always like, Rose is around, I gotta be on my toes and watch my thoughts so they don't get too out of line. So this is the intuitive side. And I wasn't... Rose at one point, very early on when I came into the group, probably 1985 is when I came into the group, probably the next year, he had pointed out to me that I was a bit sensitive. And until that point, I never really considered that sensitivity as a factor in my life. But when you start to see that, you start to see that you're getting input from far more than just this mundane, logical mind, you get more adept at it. And I want to give some examples of intuition. These are real examples from people that I've talked to over the years that would in no way fit into some kind of logical construct. So the first one here is, you know who's at the front door at your home immediately before the doorbell rings, even though the visitor was unexpected. So how could you have some kind of input, and beyond coincidence, if that happens a second or third or fourth time? And this one's happened to me many times. So you think of someone, and a few seconds later, you hear your phone, and that very person is the caller. So maybe that happens once or twice, you figure that's coincidence, but if it keeps happening, you're getting some input from something much more than just the logical side. From just the logical side of the equation. Here's one I always thought was interesting. Before opening an envelope addressed to you, so this must go way back before email, you are overwhelmed with inexplicable anger. Upon reading the letter inside, you learn that a friend has written an uncharacteristic note of outrage directed at you. They felt something through that envelope. So these intuitive thoughts seemingly arrive out of nowhere. They arrive and you are the witness. I'll put you in quotes. They are often more accurate, especially as you grow to trust them. And you often don't know the reason why you're getting these perceptions right at the time they happen, but later they tend to play out and be more accurate. One of the things I found early on in my search with intuition, and again, it's probably dating myself way before the internet, but I used to go into bookstores, I think it was E. Dalton or Walden's at the time, and there would be these countless shelves of books. And I was just, where do you start when you're faced with that kind of search? And this is, again, before I even met Rose. So I'm trying to find which of these guys are charlatans trying to sell me their book and which ones really have something. And amazingly enough, I would thumb through these books and I would end up, without talking to people, with Krishnamurti, Gurdjieff, Uspensky. So these were some pretty hardcore books with valid teachers behind them. And there was just something in me that resonated when I would pick it up and read through the words. So I feel like that was a lot of intuition. There wasn't some study of that author trying to figure out what that person had. If you really want to read the epitome of somebody who had intuitive talents, I would recommend Joseph Sidoni's Gates of the Mind. It's not more or less training you how to use your intuition, but it's just filled with these stories that are almost unbelievable, but very credible. This guy was very credible and a very good writer, and just shows probably somebody's mind who's so much more lopsided on the intuitive side versus the logical side.
Well, he was also well known by, and he wasn't some off-beaten path quack. He corresponded with presidents. He was known to industrialists and scientists. He was a mainstream person of his time.
Yeah. I think he had letters from just an amazing number of high-profile people, as you say, Einstein, some
Gandhi.
Gandhi. Yep.
Joseph Sidoni, S-A-D-O-N-Y. I think Pat might still have copies of the book they sell. I don't know.
It's on gatesofthemind.com. I believe there's a free copy. Do I have that right? Yeah. Okay, so this idea of basically, this is giving you some fodder to step back from thoughts and feelings. And that's the umpire and the intuition. The more you see that, the more you see this input, the more you can step away and separate yourself from the thoughts and feelings that you're seeing in your life. So Rose used this term, this phrase, the view is not the viewer. So the view is not the viewer. The view is what you are not. Thoughts, feelings. And that's the process observer. And Nisargadatta called it the witness. So that's point E. So we've just climbed our second rung. And I feel there's a lot of people in this room who quite grasp that quite well. And again, this is a retreat from error. So this isn't a concept. You start to experience this separation. And you, from what I remember, and I don't remember when it happened, but I really started to notice the gaps in thoughts. So it's not this continuous stream of thoughts, because you can see the gaps. And you start to get faster than your thoughts in a way, because you see them come, and you either get looped into them, they get real sticky, and you could be lost for hours or days. I was lost for days. I just remember that. And when I did come back, it was just a sudden jerk. It was like, my God, I've been asleep. How could I have let myself get that deeply asleep? And again, this is going back to my early days of just studying the mind. But the thoughts, what I see is the thoughts become less sticky over time. They don't captivate you as much. They're not as interesting. So this process observer is the mind bending in on itself. Again, seeing the logical side and the intuitive side. And you just, with time, start to really become grounded in this observer. And I'm outlining, this is my experience going up this ladder. So you actually become a process observer. This isn't a concept. Rose said that a lot. You become the truth. You never learn it. And it's like that all the way up the ladder. You become these higher qualities. It's experiential. The process observer is a portal between the mind and our true essence. So it monitors the events and patterns in its view. We may not be immediately cognizant of the fact that the mind fools itself. And this is another important principle of Rose's, that there's some aspect of you, less truthful, that tends to fool. To fool you. And maybe I can give some examples. One to me clearly is if I sit down and make a commitment to meditate and I want to do it at a certain time, there will be 100 reasons that will come up why I should not meditate. And that's sometimes they just become so believable that you get sucked into it and I say, oh, I'm not going to meditate because I've got distracted with something else. So looking with fresh eyes on intuition seems to improve sensitivity, and watching thoughts will quiet down the reasoning side of the equation. So we become increasingly in tune with the intuition as it bubbles up without the mental activity that so often suppresses our feeling side. I realize there are some people that are heavily into probably more of a feeling sense than a logical side. I tend to think that the majority of people probably are on the logical side of the equation. And the idea here is to avoid a preconceived notion of intuition and just allow it to arise by watching thought and not allowing ourselves to easily discount seemingly irrational messages from within. The entire mind realm is filled with unsolvable paradoxes, and so it's very limited. Rose describes the mind's limitations in detail, and he really goes into some of the limitations just to begin with. Our sensory input, we can't see as well as some animals, we can't hear as well, so even our sensory input to begin with is limited. Our DNA programming, our family upbringing, the moods, states of mind, the projections that we project out onto others. There's so many limitations to the mind. And he really just makes it clear, and I think everybody here understands, the mind is not going to solve this problem. It has limits, severe limits. And it was interesting, I think maybe about 6 months ago, I got into this sort of a... call it a tangent or whatever. When I was meditating, I sit and meditate every morning, and I sit for about an hour and just I love getting up and being in the silence. I love certain times of year when you get up before the birds start singing and it's just dead quiet, and then things come to life, and it's just so amazing. Life is just so amazing to dissolve into it. But sometimes there are things that I just get into a groove for some reason. And one was, I'm going to write down the traits of the mind. And so these would pop up once or twice a week, something like that, and I'd get up and put him into my phone. So let me write down, and then I had to stop myself at some point so it didn't get too out of hand. So these are some of the things that, that came to me while I was sitting. Commenting. The mind just wants to insert its comments in between what is and you. So it's just whatever the perception is, it's inserting its spin on that perception. I think it's pretty obvious to a lot of people. Comparing and contrasting. This is probably one of my downfalls. I brought up Bernadette Roberts the other day. One of the things that happened to me after my realization, I went down to Bob's, I was staying in Bob Servo's cabin, and the only thing I brought in, so I was in a period of isolation, so I went in just to take time away and do this isolation retreat out on Richard Rose's farm. And I really avoided the heady stuff. I didn't want to take that in, but I brought some poetry, and I brought these written descriptions of people's experiences. So Art Tickner, Bob Sergel, Sean Nevins, Bart Marshall, I don't know who else I had. Right after my realization, the first thing that happened, I went down to the Bob's cabin and I started reading these. And so I started to compare and contrast. And it was just what I would consider was like the mind just rushed in, it was like ego backlash, and said, that's not what happened to you. That's not what happened to you. And it just, the mind got in there and really, in a way, took me back a bit from what I experienced. It sort of rushed in. Nature suffers no vacuum. It came in and it wanted to compare and contrast. And I even brought up Bernadette Roberts the other day because her story is just so out there and so intense. It almost sounds like that's where this could possibly lead to the nth degree. And I think I like Francis's response. I thought it was very clear. Judging is a big one. Controlling. Now, logically, that one to me makes no sense anymore, but it's very easy to get sucked into it. How could we possibly control if a bird flaps its wings or somebody walking into the door? How do we know possibly what's going to happen in the next minute? And that's the mind looking to the future. It doesn't want to be right here. It doesn't want to be in the present. Expecting or anticipating, that's the same thing. So we have no idea what the next hour will bring, yet we think we can do something right now that's going to have some ramifications. And don't get the feeling that I'm saying throw everything out the window and leave everything to fate. Because I just said before when I started, determination, persistence, these are important. It's important to have. Attachment. That's the past. The mind loves the past. The stories. The stories that happened 20 years ago, we're still playing them out in our head. And you can get, this stuff gets really, really subtle. Because when you get down to, those stories seem very concrete, very real. When you get down into the thoughts that are happening now, that's where you see the sticky stuff, what I call them. So the thoughts, that's the attachment. The mind doesn't want to be here. So what does it do? A thought comes up, and all of a sudden that's the past, but you're in this loop in the past. And I'm not saying your objective should be being immune to thoughts. What I see in myself is that thoughts just become less sticky with time, so they come up, and I just let them go. Not always, but they have much less sticky qualities. That's the attachment. The mind loves to attach to stuff. resisting. And there could be a lot of lessons there. I'll give you one really good lesson that really stuck with me. I was in a retreat and with Linda Clare, and I was having trouble one day, just falling asleep. Nothing I could do. Every way I tried to maneuver myself, I did not want to fall asleep, because I felt that's just a waste of time to spend in this retreat trying to be very aware, and here I am falling asleep. So I did everything possible to push that away, to fight it. And eventually, during one of the breaks, the question and answers, I said to Linda, I said, I cannot stop myself from falling asleep. And it's funny, in retrospect, she said, well, go to sleep. She said, we all do it here. She said, let it go. You're fighting it. That's what's making you go to sleep. And it was so true, but it took her just to express that. And now it's just amazing when I have the sleepy feelings, I'm in retreats or just sitting at home. Yes, I fall asleep for 5 minutes or whatever, but it's gone. And I just come right back out of it. So the mind wants to resist, and all that does is strengthen whatever you're pushing away. I mentioned a bit of cause and effect. Again, that's doing something now, thinking that it has some absolute, certain impact 5 minutes or 5 days or 5 years from now. If you get to studying the mind, you'll see this coalescing and condensing around objects. So that to me is something captivates you, and your thoughts will go there. And if you get really fast, you'll see the movement between you and the object. So thoughts always condense around an object, but you can see actually thinking is actually the movement of towards that object, which is away from what is. Self-deluding, including conclusions about awareness. So one of the things, and I'll get into this a little bit, one of the things you'll, if you're able to step into this awareness, which is a much more subjective quality, if you're able to step into that, you'll think that that awareness is yours. And there's a lot of self-delusion in that. Narrating. And this, all I can say is blah, 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 blah. That's what the mind does. It just wants to constantly narrate. And it's, again, I don't know, I'm not prescribing any remedies for this stuff. These are just traits. Translating what is real, what is, translating into the construct, your constructs, whatever your mind is, what makes up your mind. Again, that's your whole history that's translating, interpreting. Desiring or fearing change. The mind doesn't want what is, so it desires something different, or it fears that change. And the last one here I have is complexity. What is so simple that your mind will never, ever want to be satisfied with what is, because it's so simple and so apparent. And what is present all the time. Now, the mind isn't all bad, so you can get into this trap where you objectify it and say, this is a problem. And it again, pushing it away makes it more, makes it stronger, makes it more real. So just common examples of using the mind, putting it in its right place, all the inventions we have, buildings, roads, the internet. So if the mind is focused and put in its right place, it is a wonderful tool. It's just an awful tool for spiritual search. It's just so limited that it's not going to take you into this upper part of the ladder here. So up until now, I've been describing the individual consciousness, watching the mind with the mind over time and with enough effort causes an accidental discovery of the opposite, which is awareness, which is point F. So much like our situation described earlier, where intuition is less tangible relative to the umpire, likewise, awareness is less tangible compared to the process observer. Awareness is undifferentiated, unmanifested, non-mind. And again, I mentioned before, you might recognize it as the spaces between thoughts. The separation between ego-mind stuff and the essential you becomes evident, and we become aware of the awareness. Yet we are still unable to identify the source of the awareness. So point F is seemingly God in the individual. And there's a strong conviction, if you see this dichotomy in yourself, this separation, and you know that you have a firm conviction experientially that you're not the mind, you're not your thoughts, you're not your feelings. There's a conviction that remains that that individualistic awareness is an awareness entity that will survive death. And Rose used to say, from here there really aren't any railroad tracks. And by that he meant you can't really lay out much more of predefined help. Like what I've described here, I'm able to put into words. And I think from somebody starting out without any spiritual inclination, this Jacob's Ladder can take you into a very deep place. But up until this point, what has to happen really at this point is that there is a survival, this idea that the awareness is yours, is this built-in survival ego. And that's ripped away. That's never your choice. That's in my experience in hearing others. So yesterday we mentioned the analogy of the drop of water entering the ocean, and we think some part of me, some molecule, is going, when it enters that ocean, is going to survive as a separate entity. And that's the false conviction that stops us from becoming the ultimate, capital B, becoming. So we know awareness, yet it still isn't evident what we become. And in reality, nothing of the individual becomes. Nothing can enter. That's why it's called absolute awareness. I like Bart Marshall's quote, "We're trying to maneuver the mind into a position where it disappears. And when it disappears, when all thoughts and every aspect of your individuality is subtracted, all that remains is what is." So I'll venture into the risky territory, which is absolute awareness. I mentioned that the individualized awareness was seemingly God in the individual. By contrast, absolute awareness is God in himself. Or a better description might be God unreflected, a vibrant, boundless nothingness. It is the highest reference point on Jacob's Ladder. Of course, but paradoxically, it isn't a point at all, because it's boundless, infinite essence. And again, I'm talking about this stuff. This isn't stuff that you can just believe and walk away from. I think a lot of people get wrapped into that. This is, in fact, Rose said, doubt everything. So doubt was part of his teachings. And part of that was so that when you have this dropping away, it's authentic in you. If you believe somebody else, it's going to be their experience. So when I say absolute awareness, I might describe it as one, a singularity, that immediately your mind conjures up an image of something, somethingness. Your true source has no quality of thingness. Nothing of what you think you are is part of absolute awareness. Awareness powers you. You don't power awareness. I might describe it as an infinite emptiness, a boundless no thing. But immediately your mind assembles an image of spaceness, a vast universe. And again, absolute awareness does not have boundaries. But everything is right here where you sit. So this isn't some, being around Rose, we had a very limited universe of teachers back in the 80s and 70s. So it was very personalized. Today it's very much depersonalized, you hear a lot. But boy, I had some image of some grand place that I was going to go to. And the simplicity of what is, again, is befuddling to the mind and stunning, because you thought you were after something so grand. Absolute awareness is the eye behind you, imploring you to look within. And that eye is eternally saying, be still and know that I am God. So I want to read something just to put things into context from Adyashanti, because here I'm going to stop with Rose's Jacob's Ladder and more or less personalize it from my side. So this is a catch. When you heard, I think, Francis talking and others who have this immersion into nothingness, when you dissolve and there's nothing left of what you thought you were. For one thing, it's very humbling, because there's nothing of you there. And you get into then, what then? So you have this experience of disappearance, eternality. And I will then take it from there and give you some of Adyashanti's words. The moment of awakening may or may not result in a permanent seeing. As I said, some people will tell you that unless it's permanent, the awakening is not real. What I've seen as a teacher is that the person who has a momentary glimpse beyond the veil of duality, and the person who has a permanent abiding realization, are seeing and experiencing the same thing. One person experiences it momentarily, another experiences it continuously. But what is experience if it is true awakening is the same? All are one. We are not a particular thing or a particular someone that could be located in a particular space. What we are is both nothing and everything simultaneously. It's so eloquent. The good news is that once a moment of this clear seeing has actually taken place, the aperture of our awareness can never completely close down again. And that's the change that really happens when you're lost in the absolute. After you're lost. It may seem like it has closed down completely, but it never quite does. In the deepest part of yourself, you don't ever forget, even if you've only glimpsed reality for a moment. something within you is changed forever. And I will just say from that resonates with me so much. Because one of the things that's missing here, and I left it off intentionally, was the, what's it called? The
invisible current.
Invisible current. And it's a dashed line, so it's sort of easy to miss. Over here, this is real hard. This is firm. This is a soft line coming down from the essence. In my experience, this left side was kicking and screaming and resisting the body, just fighting to get to the top of Jake's ladder. And by resisting the body, Rose advocated celibacy, and I was in my 20s. I was celibate for 8 years in my 20s. Talk about resisting what nature is telling you. That will do it. I found immense benefits from it. I had no regrets. No regrets for anything. But that line going up was just fighting like hell. And Rose actually had a formula. He said, fight like hell, but don't give a damn. And I thought that was a good, you don't really care about the outcome, but you don't have any other choice. You want this. So you fight like hell for it. Coming down. And this, I sort of like Francis, the way you described the pendulum. Because you have this ignorance. You swing into the absolute. And now you have to reconcile coming back and being. I would just say being with everything. And to me, I've had two teachers, Richard Rose and Linda Clare. Rose, to me, gave me the wisdom. That would be. And I'm sort of launching off one of the Sargadatta's quotes, but Linda Clare gave me love. And that just opened my heart. So coming back down, that's expressed in me. Using this again as the story of my discovery. Love, surrender, gratitude. And it's... I hate when I cry because then I can't communicate, but it's just the way it is. So I'll evade and use another quote. This was something, it's amazing because I wrote these notes out and a lot of the stuff has been talked about, but I had the Ramana Maharshi quotes here that I wanted to talk about. So the Kivala, which we brought up yesterday, the Kivala Nirvikalpa Samadhi is the mind is alive, sunk in light. These are quotes from Ramana Maharshi himself. Sunk in light, like a bucket tied to a rope and left lying in the well, in the water in a well to be drawn out by the other end of the rope. And then the Sahaja Nirvikalpa Samadhi, the mind is dead, resolved into the self, capital S self, like a river discharged into the ocean and identity lost. A river cannot be redirected from the ocean. And there's just a lot of different ways, and we heard it yesterday, you can take those two things. And to me, that bucket is being lost in the absolute for however long it was, a couple of minutes. But the reconciliation takes time, and it's, I could see the mind resolving itself, calming down, and that's the reconciliation. That's the pendulum coming back. That's the surrender, the love, and that's something that I really missed. And I really like what Francis was saying yesterday. Things become clearer and clearer and clearer. And you think you have a bead on it, and I feel like there will never be a bead on it. The becoming, to me, never stops. And I don't know where it'll go. I think the resistance will become less. The acceptance will become more. I have a prayer that I sometimes say at the start of my meditation. God, please give me faith, love, humility, and patience to surrender to what is. That sometimes just saying something simple like that to yourself can really make things, could change things. You think, I don't want to use words because it involves thoughts, blah, blah, blah. But just simply expressing what you want in a prayer. One of the things I'm grateful for is Rose did not have a lot of rituals, dogmas, doctrines, and I find the same with Linda Clare. It's very simple, stripped bare of all that stuff, just going to the heart. And another thing that I still find unique about Rose is his idea of subtracting from errors. And again, it's a very individualistic path, and a good teacher will allow that to blossom in each person. And that's what I find with Mr. Rose and Linda. So this, I just want to sort of close here by again repeating what he talked about, this retreat from untruth, not postulating what you want, but doing your own search and backing away from the false. And he used the term erosion of ignorance. That's what happens. That's what becomes more clear with time. And the last thing I'll say, just as a reminder, in the bottom left corner there, the ultimate in negativity, maybe. I don't know. He has death. And I just say, as a way to not get too comfortable and not feel like, as a clear example, that Tat will be here forever. Don't take anything for granted. And I think death, knowing that that's there at some point, should propel you to expedite and not sit on your laurels. So that was how I wanted to end.
Thank you.
So I guess we have time for questions and comments.
The China Aloha.
I know Rose emphasizes nostalgia a lot as well. I was curious if that was a part of your path, because he typically does the positive and negative and gives the third point is kind of a nostalgic line back to your home.
Yeah, we've had some TAP meetings with that theme, nostalgia, and there is something truer about it. I can't.
He pointed that as a mood.
Yeah, he did.
Several main moods that human beings access or become subject to, and nostalgia was one of them.
Bob Ferguson talks about it a lot too.
Yeah, yes, he does. It's. It feels to
Bob
me.
Ferguson.
Bob Ferguson, yeah. And, and
Nostalgia West.
Yeah, he has this website, even nostalgiawest.com, I think.
It'd be the dotted line.
Yeah, it's a. I think he used an expression of it was an expression of eternality, the nostalgia. And it just takes us back often to what we feel is a better time or just some. To me, the moments of beauty, you know, just not mine. You know, just sharing in something profound at that moment that's just been, that stays with us for some reason. Some of those moments stay with us. But I like that, Bob. It's just more of another expression of the dash line.
It's something that the voice communication is coming from a deeper, more real part of you.
Yeah.
Did you forget one when you were itemizing qualities of the mind? I think you left one something out.
Did I leave fear out?
Huh?
Did I say fear?
You forgot.
Did you forget one?
You forgot the last one.
Yeah. You forgot the last one.
Just give me a hint. Forgotten about it.
You got me. Yes. The forgotten, yes. One of the qualities of the mind, it was a Rose session one time. The ability of the mind to forget is a quality of the mind.
That really has an impact.
Yes. Actually, it's compassion, isn't it? For me, forgetting all the mistakes and some of the things in the past that I prefer to forget.
Be protected too from it's really a self-defense protective mechanism.
Yeah.
You mentioned. If the individual consciousness becomes test, there's a, when you move from there to G, the absolute, there's a feeling that that individual consciousness is almost ripped away, I think.
The only way, best way for me to answer is describe what happened to me. And I'll say when I was in that period of isolation, I decided I was going to meditate just for a little bit every day. My meditation was simply to sit and watch thoughts and Rose had a technique of seeing your mind, watching your mind drift from center and then seeing that and turning the head back to something neutral, you know, a neutral part. So when I went on this isolation retreat, fittingly enough, I spent so much blood and sweat in that community building, but that's exactly where it happened. So I went in there to sit down and meditate for a little bit, and I saw thoughts come up, and I did what I normally do, which was, okay, I see the thought and just come back to this neutral space where I want to be, and another thought would come up, and I came back to it. And then this, for whatever reason, I got really pissed off. And I just said, enough. And the thoughts kept drifting, and I said, no. And it got, and it's just for me. I'm just describing a situation for me and not advocating it for anybody else. But I really got heavy into resistance. And I see where Rose's system of tension plays out in this regard, where it played out in me. So the thoughts kept drifting. And I somehow started to separate from myself. And it got so odd that I asked myself, am I dreaming this? Because this, I am just seeing this, these thoughts play out in front of me. And I was then very sure that I was vividly awake in this, as this thing was ratcheting up tighter and tighter. And then a couple of things happened where I remember hearing a bee. So I saw my mind go up. It's a lofted ceiling, and there was a bee at the very top. So I sort of watched my mind go up there, and then it came back. And then I remember my hands were numb because I was sitting in this chair for a while. I must have been there a while. And I thought, if I move my hands, will it break this? And I had to move them because they were hurting, and it didn't. So these things were happening, and I remember this is where it starts to get to your point. I remember praying, and it didn't even occur to me until after the fact, when my wife said something. I was praying for help. I was praying to deceased family members. I was just pushing anything I could to break through this. Because I'd been at this for 22 years at that point, and I just had enough. So the surrender to me was about at that point where I knew I couldn't do it, and I needed something else to take me over. And what I remember was this profound electricity outside of me. And I don't know if that could have been my brain, you know, with the neurons or the fight that was going on or whatever was happening. But after a while, that intense electricity, it was so intense I was leaning away from it. I remember that. Then it flooded in. And then I was nothing. So I think this. I think that's when I say the surrender. I couldn't have scammed it, as Bart says. You know, you can't say, "Ah, I've had enough of this search. You know, I'm done." It's just not going to happen. Something. Adyashanti uses a good description. All you could do is put yourself at the gate, the gateless gate. Just keep putting yourself there, and at some point, to use an analogy, God reaches over and takes you. And that's not your choice. Your choice is to make yourself as vulnerable as possible.
Were you fasting at the time?
No, I wasn't. Charlotte asked if I was fasting. I had done some isolation retreats in the past. Rose had a couple of cabins on his farm. That was a big thing. He wanted a place where people can get away from life, go into isolation without... And these were boxes. I mean, these were plywood. They were essentially 16 by 8 cabins, very austere, you know, no electricity, no running water, no toilets. You had to walk down to an outhouse. You had to go get your spring water. And I tried fasting. And I don't have much meat on me to begin with. So what I found was my mind slowed down. And I can see why somebody who's high energy would fast, because it would just slow down the body, slow down the thoughts. Seems natural, right? Just the metabolism would slow down. And it just took every ounce of energy to walk about 20 minutes to the spring house to carry water back. And that was it for the day. I was done. So, and I just remember I couldn't get my mind off of pizza. So I will never fast again. I mean, I don't mind, you know, going hungry a little bit. But
yeah, Rose mentioned something about a caveat about fasting. It's only useful if your mind's over the thought of food or anything like that.
Mm.
It's like once you're free of that, all that. At a certain point, maybe, like I've been fasting too, like about 3 or 4 days in, you forget about food and it doesn't become important. You're in this otherworldly state where you don't feel attached as much. It's kind of dreamlike. And, yeah, but your thoughts are a lot clearer too.
You know, and that's a good point. This whole thing is just so fraught with failure. That's how I can describe it. And I'm not trying to take the wind out of anybody's sails. Rose said what set him apart from most men was his capacity to absorb failure. So I tried everything. I mean, I tried a lot of stuff, and it failed. But that's the retreat from error. That no longer was a tool that I could use. I tried it. It broke. I moved on. Scott, did you have a question before?
I just want to know, is point F awareness of an object?
Yes, it's... maybe to use the term consciousness with... I don't want to go there. It's awareness. It's no objects. But it's aware all the objects are not awareness. Thoughts are objects.
Do you have a sense of the what the conundrum is that puts E and F in tension, or how you talk about them?
Intention. You mean as in two words?
Right.
Intention. Right. Okay. Yeah, you're trying to reconcile what you feel is a truer part of yourself with what you feel is false. And it's that, again, going back to my discovery, my koan was, I'm aware. Where is awareness? That was the tension. Is it out here? Is it in here? Where is the source of awareness? That was my question.
Phil, while you were saying that, it just occurred to me, the process observer seeing external processes, whereas the individual awareness of consciousness is like an internal awareness. It's kind of like a two-way seeing. So it's like, where is that? It seems like where the tension is right there.
Yeah. And at that point, the mind is necessary. It's like a mirror. The mind is necessary in a way. To know that you're aware. But the false conviction is that belongs to you, or you might not know where it is.
Right, because I look at like any one of the, you know, spectrums that you triangulate to a higher point of observation is they're two sides of one coin. And so it's like there's something that's being an assumption that's carrying over anywhere across that spectrum. And yet that's got to be brought into tension. Because it's like at some point, you know, you could be a process observer and not really have much of an issue going into awareness and those not becoming, you know, obviously in conflict. And so, but, I mean, what you said, really, it's like that's the point at which there seems to be a contradiction that you're now beginning to see.
Yeah, and one thing I didn't make clear is that this is not, there's lots of shades in between here. So it's not like you're just ultimately aware and all mind. It's not that crisp. There's a lot going on between those two, and it fades in and out slowly, perhaps, between those two. What you find, what I found, in asking that question now it's in my face. It's almost like God's sense of humor, in a way, is what is the source of awareness? Well, it's everywhere. It's right here. It doesn't belong to anybody. It's so obvious and evident that that's sort of God's joke on me, I guess. You want to know the source of awareness? Here it is. It's now and now and now. But it does. There's this reconciliation or integration or whatever the word for me is very important. And so my experience is it's not always abiding in it. And that's what I sort of crave. Maybe that's to my detriment, I don't know.
What is it that you would be abiding in? Because it seems like what you're talking about is the disappearing of a confusion. And that's not a state.
My sense is the subtraction would just continue, that the mind would subside. And what I mean by coming and going, it's very intense right now. It's very intense for me when I sit in a retreat in the lab. And that's becoming more common or more prevalent. But there are times when perhaps it's just accepting that it's not going to be like that. And I get lost completely back into thought. Larry?
You said 10 minutes.
10?
Yes.
When you first expressed it, you said your calling was, where is awareness? Is the way you expressed it. Does that mean that at that point, back then, you were, part of the struggle was, you know, is it in the mind or outside of the mind? Is that part of the tension or what you were struggling with?
No, I could see the mind was not me. It was not the essential quality of me. But for some reason, I could not clearly understand where the awareness was. It's like I wanted it to, you know, I felt, I would hear, I'd go to TAP meetings and I hear people describe it, and I was saying, well, is it out there or is it somewhere in me? And that was the koan.
So it was more inside or outside of you, but not mind.
Yeah.
It was clear to you at that point it wasn't in the mind.
It was clear to me that the qualities of the mind were not it, were not the essence.
But was it clear to you that it, at that point that it couldn't be a quality of the mind? You know, you listed all these qualities of the mind.
Well, and at that point, that was the resistance.
I'm trying to
that
was the resistance. Give me a railroad track, that last track.
Yeah, and it gets tricky because I'm getting into particulars with myself, and that's there's a lot of drawbacks when I talk about my experience that really I could see where that could lead people to believe that's what has to happen to me.
Right.
And there's the mind comparing and contrasting.
Yeah.
And it never will be like that. It will never be duplicated because how could it? It was in 2007. It's gone. It's an experience that came and went. It can never be duplicated. And who could ever duplicate you or me in our manifestation? We're just so unique.
The other thing, when you were mentioning these qualities of the mind that keep, you know, and you keep observing those and see how they crop up, and I think you said something about that gets subtler and subtler.
Is that correct?
Thoughts get subtler and subtler. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I noticed recently, which seems to be a kind of sadistic trick the mind is playing, is spiritual thoughts coming up, which basically are no different than any other thoughts, but if they're spiritual, they at least for me have a little more stickiness. Is this making sense?
Yeah. It's an ego. It's a spiritual ego.
Right. Right.
It's better than having a sports ego, right?
I'm not so sure.
It's not. It's worse by far.
Sports ego. Give me a sports ego any day to deal with.
Not a spiritual ego. Oh my God.
Seems to be an assault on sports, which I rebel against.
Say something, because of Michael's made a comment that made me think that he had an image that there was like a, you're walking these lines linearly, so you go from A, B to C, then to D, then to E, then to F, then to G, and if you don't go from E to F to G, you're operating on this line. The possibility of triangulation comes about, or the realization of it. I think of each of these lines as an object of the attention. So if you're lost, if you're oblivious and you're just functioning on line AB, that's your existence. But everybody, when you're operating at that existence, there is a triangulation. There's the triangulation is the umpire kind of monitoring the process. So you start making an active, you act on a desire to know more. You have some hidden lines there. And you start, as soon as you start looking at this, now you're operating on, when this line becomes the object of your attention, this materializes. I mean, not that it comes into existence whereas it didn't exist, but I talk about when afflictions to the sense of self, in that. Something that afflicts your sense of self in that moment, there's a direct line open to your source, because you're this would be I'm losing my train of thought here.
Triangulation.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, there's no zigzagging up there, as you say, when it becomes the object of attention.
Well, I would think the discovery of each triangulation point would be like a eureka experience or some sort of like cool discovery, along the way.
Sometimes it's more.